You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, I'm joined by my special guests, Mary Dzhevsky and John Everard, to discuss the day's top news stories. As the crisis in Calais kicks into a higher gear, we'll ask if there's a realistic solution to the migrant issue that's heating tempers on both sides of the channel. Then, should America be cozying up to yet another Egyptian strongman? We'll debate the pros and cons. We'll also look at the plummet in Greek manufacturing and ask if the country's bailout has been rendered all but meaningless. All that, plus food vigilantes in Russia, and we'll ask if Vice President Joe Biden might drop the vice come November. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. I think we're going to have to explain that vice comment later on. We even mean vice president, of course, before we get any calls from the White House. Now, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist Mary Dzhevsky and also John Everard, a former British ambassador to a variety of hotspots around the world. Welcome both to the programme. Now, last night, French police reported 1,700 attempts by migrants in Calais to break into the Channel Tunnel's freight terminal. The staggering numbers continue to add up. It's thought that there are roughly 3,000 migrants in Calais, and 9 have died whilst attempting to access the tunnel since June. Mary, a kind of a complicated, bleak, you know, difficult problem. Where do you think people really should begin with this? You know, all the focus is on, which is quite rightfully, on stopping these people getting through the tunnel. But that isn't the solution to 3,000 people sitting in Calais.
No, and some people put the numbers much higher because they say they're not all actually in this sort of woodland area called the jungle now. I think it's hugely difficult because on the one hand, you've got the security issue. And, you know, to my mind, it is an issue of the security of a national border, our national border, the British national border. And on the other hand, it's a humanitarian issue. When you look at the conditions that people are living in. Now, okay, they've traversed, in some cases, half of Africa to get there. Some of them come all the way from Syria. They've crossed the Mediterranean in equally atrocious conditions. But the fact is that they're in France. They're in the European Union. And these conditions are totally unworthy of developed countries. And so I think it is a totally intractable problem. But my feeling, and I know this is a minority feeling, is that somehow there are going to have to be troops brought in, not to exercise sort of armed force, but in order to restore a degree of order which will make it possible to sort out people, decide who is going to be sent back, who's going to be admitted to the various European countries, because I don't think that the civilian authorities at the moment are up to it.
John, when you look at this situation, what's intriguing is, I guess, you know, that there hasn't been this, you know, what Mary's talking about is a break where we can draw breath and think about what we should really be happening. But what's interesting is we are talking on the whole about 3,000 plus men, young men, all sitting there in Calais. What's strange about this situation is, you know, that there's a pecking order of who's, you know, potentially going to get through and who's the focus on. All kind of young men. You wonder what happens to kind of, you know, all the women who are trapped in poverty or who are facing, you know, persecution, where the kids have ended up. You know, it feels like, it sometimes feels like one of those kind of demonstrations where the noisiest person is at the front. And do you worry about the weaker people back down the chain? That, you know, that's the problem with not doing any assessment really, you know, before these people get to Calais.
Yes, I do worry about the weaker people, as you put it, Andrew. But there again, the presence of almost exclusively young men, as you rightly point out, is a typical pattern of migration. It tends to be the young men who will leave their homelands and to try to earn money for their families. And the families, horribly, are very often held hostage, effectively, by the people traffickers. And one of the interesting points, I think, to come out of this really quite bold statement over the weekend, the Franco-British joint statement on how they're going to work together, was the clear recognition that a lot of the problem is that the people traffickers are actively talking up the UK as a kind of El Dorado and convincing people that if only they can get to the UK, specifically, if they can only get to London, that the streets are paved with gold, you get free handouts, and that life's a dream from then on, which, for those of us who live in London, we know is not entirely true. There's an information war to be won here. Where do we go from here? It's become fashionable to say that you cannot solve this problem just with more fences. That's only partly true. Strong fences would actually be a significant deterrent to those trying to cross. Part of the problem has been that Eurotunnel, to their shame, haven't even fixed the gaps in the fences that were there 3 years ago when this problem started. Physical barriers are important. Remember, too, that although a lot of the people in Calais have nowhere to go back to. If you're Syrian, you can understand that almost anywhere looks better than Syria. But a high proportion of these people are pure economic migrants. A lot of Eritreans, a surprising number of Pakistanis. And where you have people of that kind, provided you can convince them that getting to the UK is not an option, you can do deals, pay for return flights, send them back, and hope that they spread the word that the London route just doesn't work anymore.
No, you're right. You know, there's obviously some people here who are economic migrants, but I guess, you know, the challenge for all of us is, you know, if you were sitting in a country where, you know, you knew you were going to earn, you know, a few dollars a month, you knew that the opportunities for your kids were minimal at best, and, you know, there's certainly no chance of an education, and you thought that actually if I risk it, you know, it may be tough, I may not get through, but I could end up living in Denmark, having free education, and, you know, being, you know, getting a job, and that would be hope for my kids. You can see that, you know, economic migrant maybe, but even so, would we take that, you know, would we think that we would sit still and let, you know, fate on, you know, destroy us, or would we try and make, you know, a break for somewhere you can get, you know, you can get a better living?
Well, absolutely. I can understand what drives these people. I mean, they're not stupid. That the calculations they're making are entirely rational. What we have to do is to explain that they're based on false premises, that when you get to the UK, you are not going to get all the things that the people traffickers are telling you you're going to get. The other point is that for the most part, these are not the poorest of the poor. These are people who found hundreds, often thousands of dollars to pay people traffickers. So a lot of middle-class people in there for whom a payoff of some kind to set up a business back home might well be an incentive to abandon their attempt to get into the UK and go back where they came from.
So if we is the logic that, you know, Mary, do you think that if we have this pause, if, you know, an effective security barrier goes up, that people can no longer get through, that it's policed in a coordinated and rigorous way, that then you could begin assessment of these people, then you could start processing them and deciding, you know, whether they, you know, they should be sent back or they should be given actually leave to remain in some other European country?
I think one of the very interesting things so far is that, as it were, the solidarity between the French and the British authorities has actually held up. For one, I wouldn't have predicted that. I would have expected the French and the British to be at each other's throats. To an extent, popular opinion on both sides of the channel is, with people blaming each other for the situation there. But I think it's very interesting, and maybe a measure of the lack of immediate solutions, that the authorities on both sides are trying to present a united front. Because, of course, the British are terrified that the French could actually stop policing altogether, which would be pretty much a free-for-all for people into the UK. And it's not, you know, the British don't have proper exit controls. There's really no reason why we should be expecting the French to be preventing people from leaving France. So I think that, you know, security is definitely part of the answer. I wouldn't actually exclude the fact that there's going to have to be some long-term rethinking about definitions and legal definitions of things like asylum seekers, conditions for granting asylum, the distinction between economic migrants and refugees. I think that at the moment these things are becoming so confused that in a way it allows people to say, no, you can't come in, and it also allows people to say, yes, you can come in, and the rules just need to be, I think they need to be different for different circumstances.
John, just before we move on, do we have any moral responsibility here for being, many people accuse us of not being very, you know, very mindful when we went into Libya, that we were, our policy in Syria has been a failure, that that's why these places are a mess, and, you know, partly because of our involvement or our entanglements with them. Do you feel that we have any moral responsibility on that front to take the people who have come from those countries?
I think you have to ask yourself whether Libya or Syria would be in more or less of a mess if we hadn't acted as we have. I, for one, am not convinced that we do have the moral responsibility you just described. We certainly don't have it in the case of the Eritreans, the Pakistanis, the Nigerians in these camps, where, of course, what is driving them is not war, but simple economic opportunity.
Well, it's a good point, actually. We should, at this point, bring in our second story today, because we're going to move on to Egypt, where America's top diplomat has restarted the so-called strategic dialogue between Washington and Cairo, which has been on a bit of a hiatus since 2009. And once again, this has raised howls of contempt by human rights activists who wonder why America is cozying up to yet another strongman in the country. Now, I guess the reason for, you know, John Kerry being intrigued by Cairo and what's going on there is just what we're talking about. You know, he doesn't want to see, you know, he'd rather see a strong man, Mary, than a failure.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, they will look at Libya and contrast it with Egypt, and they will say, well, actually, which is easier to deal with? Where is life actually marginally more tolerable? And they were plump for Egypt. And it's all very well to keep the Egyptian leadership at arm's length and to say, well, we don't like the way they came to power. It's a tragedy what happened to the revolution. Everything seems to be turned back. But I think there are other considerations here, which include potential disorder on the border with Libya, but also what seems to be in the forefront of many minds is potential disorder in Sinai. And then you're looking at that spreading into Israel, into Jordan, and you're looking at the whole mess of Syria and Iraq just getting bigger and bigger.
John, would that be your reading? Oh yeah, let's face it, it's still a huge chunk of the world's trade chugs through the Suez Canal, which has just been widened and deepened. You know, it's still one of the most important conduits for trade. And that runs right up past the Sinai.
It does. I think Mary's absolutely right to put. I mean, one a senior American official, anonymous as ever, was asked point blank why Kerry was doing this, and he said simply Sinai. That is what's driving this: the fear of Islamic State spreading into Egypt. It's bad enough that they are doing what they're doing in Iraq and Syria, but the thought that Egypt might go the same way, I think, sends shivers up and down spines in Washington. Also, I think it's important to remember, before we accuse the United States of cynicism in cozying up to Sisi in the way that Kerry has, that firstly, Egypt has choices. If the Americans won't give Egypt what it wants, others will. And secondly, we shouldn't assume that we know everything that is going on. I, for one, think it is very likely that understandings have been reached, that undertakings have been given before Kerry made this announcement, and I suspect that those will have something to do with what Egypt might do to counter the menace of Islamic State.
Well, let's cross the Mediterranean, not far. We're going to go to Greece, because before
what's
we
left of it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're going to discuss. Because before we head to the break, the Athens stock market reopened today, and it plummeted by some 30%. And meanwhile, new figures are showing that Greek manufacturing has all but been destroyed in recent months. Mary, you know, a great show by, you know, Syriza, kind of, you know, tweaking the tails of every kind of European nation, you know, fighting, you know, the good fight, then giving up at the last minute. But this feels a little bit like, you know, something tragic like the miners' strike here in the UK, where, you know, you have a rightful cause, you know, you have impassioned people, you have people with beliefs, and they see something is going wrong. But in the end, all those months of striking, which effectively is what happened in Greece, when you look around, when you look what's left, you know, whether you're victorious or not, it doesn't look very pretty.
No, I think that is true. And the trouble was that right through the Greek crisis, this sort of situation has been on the cards. It's been hidden in a way. I mean, the reality of it has been evident to people who are there, but it's been hidden in a way from the rest of us, because we've all been preoccupied by whether Greece was going to leave the euro, whether the economy was going to collapse completely in a sort of theoretical currency sense. But now the reality of what's actually happened to the Greek economy and how it can possibly pull back from this. I think if there's a sliver, a very, very small sliver of hope, it is that with the plunge in the stock market, there is maybe a more realistic relationship between stock prices, the currency, and the actual state of the economy than there was before. But that is very, very small consolation.
John Murray did a very good job there trying to find some glimmer of hope in these really horrendous figures. What's your reading?
I agree with Mary. I think that it's helpful to have the various economic indicators, you like, brought into rough balance. The problem, of course, is that they're all pointing very rapidly downwards. Not only has the stock market virtually collapsed, as you just pointed out, but if you look at the numbers, you can see that you cannot give Greek banks away anymore. They are not only worthless, their value is probably negative because they have attracted such vast amounts of debt. It's going to be almost impossible to re-establish the Greek financial system on the previous basis. But there's a broader point here too. We're just in the middle of negotiating the third Greek bailout. And right from the off, the IMF said that the numbers simply do not stack up. And that was an analysis based on the figures before this latest crash. As of now, arithmetically, this isn't a political judgment, this is just numbers. Greece cannot pay this money back. And at some point, there is going to be a crunching and extremely painful default, with all the consequences that we've spent most of this year trying to avoid. Things are going to go bang, and there's no getting out of it this time.
And the terrible thing is, you know, whatever your politics, you know, and you know, before Syriza came in, you know, the feeling was that Greece would kind of grow its economy by 1 or 2% this year, that there would be some minor expansion of the economy, and next year that could be a little bit bigger. That has all been completely wiped away. And the other funny thing is, when you look at Greece, it's still got lots of good things. It's like a third of the world's shipping is owned by Greeks. It's got some of the biggest bauxite mines. You know, it's good in food. It's good in olive oil. It's got, you know, a good agricultural business somehow still ticking along. But all of these things seem to have been lost in the mix because of this terrible layer of debt. Do you know, when you, either of you, look at Greece, you know, do you feel that if there was some slack cut, if there was a bit of a rethink by, or if Syriza wasn't in power perhaps, and suddenly you had a government that was, you know, the West looked more amenable to, that there's still a hope for it?
No, it's had it. The 6 months ago, the situation was retrievable. It's no longer retrievable. The numbers have gone too far. And I think that when we come to write this up in the history books, we will have to admit that Syriza has damaged Greece irreparably.
I think I'm marginally more optimistic. Just for the sake of being a bit kinder to the Greeks, I think, yes, if another government was in charge, then maybe things would look better, more realistically better. But in a way, Greece has things going for it, as you listed. And it's simply a tragedy that exactly at this time of year, when people could realistically go from all over Europe, could take their holidays in Greece, it appears that people are shunning Greece because they think of it being in economic chaos rather than actually needing their economic help.
Absolutely. That is the tragedy, that Greece does have things going for it. And before Syriza came in, you had the basis of a solution. It would be slow, it would be painful, it would be very long term. But now that manufacturing has gone to pot, the tourist industry is going to be in deep trouble, it's very difficult now to believe in such solutions.
And there is that strange thing that I think, you, while the tourist season is on and there's a huge number of people who are employed in seasonal labour, there's another kind of hit become, you know, in autumn when those jobs disappear and the hotels shutter. Although intriguingly, a friend of mine who's just come back from Greece said that he was struck by how in many of the hotels he stayed at, many of the seasonal workers were not Greek. There were people coming in from Bulgaria and Romania, still, you know, I guess doing the jobs even cheaper. Even Greece is kind of like managed to find someone who will do the work for even less. But we're going to pause the holiday chat for a moment. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with John Everard and Mary Jadevsky after this, when we're going to talk about Russian food vigilantes and the political future of Joe Biden.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's Travel Guide series, published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the program delivers definitive insights into the people, places, and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to the Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Still with me, of course, is Mary Jezewski and John Everard. I'm not letting them go anywhere. We're going to be talking food next, probably have a buffet up next, because we're going to go to Russia, where one Kremlin-backed group of food vigilantes has been on a mission to track down foreign delicacies in the country. The group called Eat Russian last month seized more than 70 types of cheese from a high-end supermarket chain. There's currently a one-year-old trade embargo underway in Russia, where Western food products such as meat, dairy and produce are not allowed into the country. 70 types of cheese. That's quite a lot of cheese, isn't it? I had a nice kind of feast that night. John, is this sensible, scary? What do you make of this?
I think it's simply funny. I love the idea of cheese prohibition. I mean, are we going to see the beginning of whatever the cheese equivalent of speakeasies are in Moscow, where people gather in darkened rooms and munch Parmigiano with somebody guarding the door all the time?
Because I see the Parmesan is one of the... Because they've managed to find alternatives for lots of things, but Parmesan, it seems, you know, they've got some alternative from a Mansk or something, but it's not quite cutting the mustard, as if you're allowed to bring mustard in either. Mary, what did you make of this story?
Well, I think it does have, I mean, I agree that it's hugely entertaining. But I think there is a serious aspect here, of course, beyond somebody going out there to try and stop what they see as sanctions busting, that it's another manifestation of sort of drumming up patriotism in Russia, which can get to extremes. And I don't think we've seen any outright violence on the food vigilante front. But nonetheless, it is a sign of the times that people are prepared to discriminate and destroy things that come from abroad just because they come from abroad. And I think it's also worth seeing this in a slightly longer term context, that if you go back 25 years, there were hardly five sorts of cheese in Russia. The idea that there's sort of 60 or 70 and many of them imported, you know, this is a complete transformation brought about by Russia joining the international economy and Russia having a market economy of its own. Russian supermarkets actually in a lot of major towns, not just Moscow and St. Petersburg, are absolutely fantastic. I would love to have one of the small supermarkets that you find in Moscow on street corners. I would love to have one close to me in London. So I think it's unfortunate that this sort of bitter patriotism seems to be taking hold, even this marginal way.
But we should be fair, just jumping in here, John, because, you know, actually when the whole kind of gay rights thing kind of kicked off, you know, criticising Russia, there were many groups here saying, don't drink Russian vodka because, you know, you're supporting kind of, you know, Russian industry and a kind of bunch of homophobes. You know, so it's kind of, everyone tries to have a go at this kind of food politics thing.
Yes, that's right. It's not just the Russians who do it, though not all of us have vigilantes going around checking restaurants and checking supermarket shelves. Mary's quite right to point to the rather unpleasant aspect of this drum-beating patriotism in which Putin and his government seem to specialise. I think the obverse of the coin is that Putin's early legitimacy was built on increased economic prosperity. And a lot of Russians, particularly middle-class Russians, have got used to enjoying decent French wine and proper French or Italian cheese. To have that taken out of their lives is not going to amuse them at all. And I think Putin may find that part of this backfires on him.
But of course, you know, Russians aren't unique in this. You know, I'm just remembering when you mentioned this, that all we have to do is go across the Atlantic and remember when the Americans were protesting against French objection to the Iraq War, and they were pouring Beaujolais down the drains in New York City.
Remember freedom fries.
Freedom fries in the Senate.
Now, yes. I'm going to have to interrupt you with your nice food talk. You should be on the menu, you two. I don't think you're on the wrong show. Now, we're going to talk about Joe Biden, who'd like a nibble at the cheese himself, I think. He'd like to have a nibble, apparently, at being vice president. Well, those are the rumours, and that's what we're talking about, him dropping the vice. We weren't talking about his private behaviour. Now, John, do you think that's got them in a sweat?
No, I don't.
Camp Clinton, of course, we're talking about here.
Sure, I understand. I think that obviously Hillary Clinton is not going to actively welcome another rival for the candidacy for the presidency. But I think she's much more worried about Bernie Sanders than about Joe Biden. I think the clear threat from the Democratic left is more worrying for her and for her political advisors than anything Joe Biden's going to throw at her. Indeed, somebody of Biden's quality would probably sharpen up the campaign, which I think Hillary is still odds on to win, and may even strengthen her position when she finally goes on to fight whoever it is the current Republican mess brings forth.
Mary, you're a good old Washington thinker. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that Joe Biden would actually have a real chance. I think the one thing against him is age. I mean, it's being pointed out.
He's 72, isn't he?
Yes, and it's being pointed out that if he did become president, he would be older even than Ronald Reagan when he took office. And I think that would be quite an adverse point. But I have to admit that 6 months ago, I actually half expected Hillary Clinton to decide not to run, for all the reasons why her particular weaknesses are now being exposed. And I was wrong about that. But I'm not convinced she's actually in as good a position as you think she is. I wouldn't be at all surprised if she actually leaves the campaign before even contesting or early in the primaries. Because I think the baggage that she's got is overwhelming. I think there are all the questions about, you know, the Clinton versus Bush all over again that is a problem. And I think that the woman thing, I think, is almost for the first time, is probably a positive, that she'll have a lot of support from women voters. But I'm not sure that it's enough. I think there are too many things against her that keep coming out of the woodwork.
John, do you think that she's suffering from being a bit too fast to kind of declare it in a way, that we knew her intentions a bit too early? You know, here's Biden kind of biding his time, as it were, and it gives you a little bit of strength when you join the race.
Yes, I think there's elements of truth in that. Of course, when you declare your candidacy is always a very nice judgment. Did she miscall it? Well, we're going to find out in due course, aren't we? Could I at this point introduce a note of caution? We're talking almost as if Joe Biden has declared. Emphatically, he hasn't. And the idea that he might declare is still fairly
embryonic.
That's
never stopped us before speculating, so watch it now.
Okay, we can speculate, but I just want to point out that, for example, the New York Times, as of an hour ago, on its website, has still got Joe Biden as probably not. We'll have to see, but I don't think we should jump too soon.
Mary, I don't mean this in a bad way, but he's got a very nice edge lately because of the very grown-up and wonderful way that he dealt with the death of his son, Beau Biden. Do you think that's put him in the public mind as a little bit more charismatic, a little bit more human, kind of giving him the kind of edge, oddly, that could help him?
Yes, absolutely. I think that he's sort of entered the public consciousness in a very dignified way, and in a way which a lot of Americans can identify with. And they think of him in that way as suddenly presidential material in a way that maybe he didn't seem so before. As you say, it's in some ways it's dreadful to say this, that a terrible personal calamity, the death of his son, I think at the age 46, from a brain tumour after being ill for quite a long time, that the way he sort of dealt with this publicly has put him on the presidential map.
Well, thank you both very much. We're going to have to leave it there for today. But that's Mary Jajewski and John Everard, who have joined me today on Midori House, because it's time to say goodbye. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Alcocer-Pacheco and by Malcolm Charchoglin, and also Paige Reynolds. They're all big cheeses in their own right. Our studio manager Also a hard cheese himself, Mr. Toby Hammond. And for the next half hour, Christopher Law will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. We'll be checking in from our Istanbul bureau, so expect a bit more Eastern flavour than normal. Then at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. And the show, well, of course, is going to be back at the same time tomorrow. What else? But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.